1990, Brian O'Day was arrested after a massive DEA investigation and subsequently spent 10 years in prison for importing marijuana into the United States. He joins me this morning to talk about a new book he's written, High, Confessions of a Pot Smuggler. It retails for $34.95 and is published by Random House. It is the story of his life from a childhood in Newfoundland that includes sexual abuse by priests to selling drugs for money, excitement and escape to recovering from cocaine addiction to hard time at Terminal Island in the Los Angeles Harbor. It is an interesting life and, needless to say, a compelling book. Brian O'Day is now a film and television producer in Toronto and regularly speaks about his experiences to young people struggling with addictions. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Brian O'Day. Good morning, Mr. O'Day.
Good morning, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. We'll talk about the lows, because there are a few in the book, but you've had some highs, both metaphorically and figuratively speaking. What were some of them?
Some of the highs, yeah. Wow. Well, you know, the greatest high was getting sober in 1988, but perhaps you want to know some of the highs from the business that I was in.
Yeah, well, I was very interested to know why people are attracted to drugs, whether that's taking them or selling them, or I guess there's something, I don't know what it is. Is it people, I don't know if they're reading them from books, but certainly from television or movies, there's some sort of glamorous aspect to it. Were you drawn to that sort of?
It wasn't the glamour. Glamour had nothing to do with it. It was what I understand today is that people who do and use and abuse drugs of any kind are looking for God or looking for a higher power. And people who get addicted to drugs actually find it. The problem is that the power that they find is greater than them, but it's a destructive power. And so that's the good news about drug abuse. And drugs meaning alcohol, tobacco, any of it. We're all looking in that use. We're looking for something to get us out of the present, something to get us away from the here and now. And so drug use, abuse, it's a symptom of a greater problem. It's a symptom of a living problem. And we need to track our life back to find out where that began. And in my case, it probably began when I was 11 years old.
And was that at St. Bond's?
Yeah, that's right.
When I read that, I thought of Mount Cashel, because is that close by geographically?
I lived across the street from Mount Cashel. Same people at St. Bond's, same order of teachers in both places. And horrific abuse went on at Mount Cashel, but it wasn't limited to Mount Cashel. It's just that the boys were captive there because they were orphans. And in a certain sense, the people who it happened to at St. Bond's or any other school were captive during the hours that they were at school.
And so you were sexually abused at St. Bond's, were you?
I was.
It's not like I'm prying into this. You talk about this in the book.
Absolutely, openly. In recovery, we have a saying that we're as sick as our secrets, and today I have none. I gladly put them out there. When I go and speak in schools and kids hear me tell what some are keeping secret, and I survive even telling it out loud and in public, it helps others to cross over that place and be able to tell whatever it is that they're holding. Secrets are a terrible thing. It's not what happened that day, per se, that was what was really wrong. It's what did not happen that day. And what did not happen that day was that I did not tell anybody about it. So I kept it a secret, and secrets require other secrets to keep them intact, which require lies, and, you know, gradually we build these huge walls of secrets and lies around us so that there's no getting out or getting in.
Now, the Christian brother that was involved at St. Bond's, he's still around, is he? And whatever happened to him?
He, as far as I know, lives in Newfoundland, and he's retired and old.
There were no charges pressed or anything like
no.
that? You talk about looking for God. Was that what you were looking for? And I guess, have you found him, her, whatever?
Well, it occurred to me in a moment of clarity that if there was a power greater than me, there's no one-sided coin. There is no yes without a no. There's no up without a down. And so one day in that logical awareness, it occurred to me that if there is a power greater than me that can bring about my destruction that I take in, surely there must be a power from within that can bring about my construction. That's the flip side to that coin. And so, yeah, you know, I'm constantly on a quest for that power. You call it God, call it whatever you want. want. It's greater than me, of which I am a part of, but not all of. And I'm constantly looking to increase my understanding and awareness and acceptance of that.
You talk about in the book. We'll talk about sort of when you were in the business of drug dealing, if we can call it that, mm-hmm. or in the throes of addiction. You talk about a lot of luck that you had along the way, and a couple of things that are slightly humorous. People knowing your name when you were in the airport, and you managing to get through with some drugs in your suitcase. You passed out in a plane, I think, and the customs agent actually carried your bag through.
Yeah, that's right.
A
police officer, actually.
Yeah, police officer. Do you think that, is that luck, or do you think that's some other power that you were trying to seek helping you at the same time?
Gosh, who knows? You know, I guess it just wasn't my time. And now as I look back over my life and look at the chips having fallen where they did, and I realize that there was a time for me to deal with this wreckage, and it just wasn't then. I don't know what protected me at that point, but it just simply wasn't my time for whatever reason. They call it destiny. My destiny had to do with showing up at Terminal Island on July 30th, 1991, to begin that 10-year bit. And once before that in 1972, I went to Newfoundland for, I got 19 months at that time. But, I have no idea. How did I survive those things so blindly? It must have been the hand of God, as they say.
Now, July 30th, what was it, 1990, you said?
1991, I checked in there. Uh-huh.
Weren't you supposed to be in there a month earlier?
I was, but I was supposed to be in there on June 30th, actually.
And how did you get out of that?
Well, on June 29th, I looked around my place in Santa Barbara and realized that I had been in complete denial about where I was supposed to be tomorrow, because everything was still there, all my clothes were still in the drawers, I'd not dealt with any moving anything or closing up the house or doing anything. And it occurred to me that I got a problem here. So I called my lawyer, and he was out of town. And I was only left with one option, that was to call the district attorney. So I called the district attorney in Seattle, Mark Bartlett, and he said, "Brian, I can't talk to you." And I said, "Mark, you've got to talk to me. My lawyer's away, and I've got to tell you that, look, I want to go serve my sentence, but I'm not ready today."
Really?
Yeah. And he said, "Well, Brian, I can't do anything about that." And I said, "Look, please, I will show up. I just need another month to get it together. Would you please talk to Judge Kuhnauer and ask him if he can just give me another 30 days?" So he said, "All right, let me see what I can do." And now at this point, Mark had become kind of a fan. He'd gotten a lot of mail from friends of mine in Santa Barbara and other places who didn't think that going to prison was a good idea and didn't think it was right. Now, whether it was right or wrong, I'm not here to say. I in fact, was ready to go and get it over with and deal with it, but I just wasn't ready at that moment. So he did. He called and was able to get me an extra few days, and that's what happened.
Now, it said that you had bills to pay, and you couldn't pay them, of course. There was the phone bill, and they wouldn't let up. Did you eventually pay the phone bill?
No, I didn't, to tell you the truth. I came out, and all of that had gone. I by the time I got out of there, they throw that stuff away in those companies after a certain point.
Well, I was really interested. It was a really neat story. You phoned the phone company, and you said, "I couldn't pay."
Mm-hmm.
And you thought that they'd show some leniency, I guess, or mercy, and cancel the bill.
Yeah.
But then they said, "No, you'll just pay us when you get out."
That's right.
What was the to use a trite phrase now, thanks to Malcolm Gladwell, the tipping point? What was the tipping point for you? Getting caught by the DEA and this 10-year sentence? Or,
no.
I mean, if you didn't get caught, I mean, would you still be doing what you were doing then?
No. My tipping point, I love that tipping point. I'm looking for a tipping point with the book. My tipping point where I tipped over and my life turned around, it was when I just had too much dough and not enough brains. And after, when we did this last big deal that we did up in the Pacific Northwest, just south of Vancouver in the United States and in Alaska, an agreement we had in our group, and there were 110 of us, was that wouldn't do cocaine. If you did coke, you were out. And so for that 2-year period while we were working on that, I didn't. However, when it was over, I bought myself a kilo of coke, pretending to buy it to show to somebody, but, you know, I just wanted it myself. And that was building my threshold, and through which I was to pass. I did coke like most people did not. I did it until it was gone, and I just couldn't make that amount go. And after 8 days of no sleep and going nuts with it, drinking a lot of booze and smoking nonstop cigarettes, I ended up doing the fish, as they say, on a friend's floor, and he found me, and I found myself in hospital for a month. And my wife left me, took the kids, told me not to come home. She didn't want to see me, and didn't want the kids to see me, and my entire life and everything that I loved just crumbled and was taken from me. But I knew one thing, that if I was to ever see any of the things that I loved again, I had to change my life entirely, and I had to stay sober. You know, when I went out on the floor there, I remember it is being given a choice of living or dying, and the choice was entirely my choice. And living came with a condition, and the condition was changing everything about my life. And if this is life, then that's what I choose, and I chose. And so in getting sober, I just knew that I wanted to stay sober, so I stuck around Santa Barbara at the hospital where I got sober. I became the head of volunteers, and I ran a couple of group therapy sessions there called Real Presence. And it was just the greatest time of my life. So for 2 years, that's all I did, was work at that hospital, stay very close to people who were getting sober, who wanted to be sober, worked with them, and hung with people who were doing that, went to 2 and 3 meetings every day, recovery meetings. And one morning I was lying in bed. It was 2.5 years or so after I'd first gotten sober. And I was thinking about a fellow who'd just gotten to the hospital the night before, and I was thinking that I wanted to go over and see him, see how he was doing, and a knock came on my door, and honestly, Joe, before I moved a muscle or had another thought, I knew who was behind that knock. I just had the ring of the wreckage of my past. And sure enough, you know, I glanced over to look through the mini blinds that was leading out to the door leading out onto the deck, and I saw a hand with a gun in it, and I just knew these weren't robbers, these were cops. And I opened the door, and the guy said, is your name Brian O'Day? And I said, oh, I wish it wasn't, but it is.
Brian O'Day is my guest, and we're talking about his book, a compelling read. You ought to get the book, High Confessions of a Pot Smuggler, $34.95, published by Random House. You read a great deal about prison life. Is it like what we see on television or in movies? And I guess that there's a certain culture to it amongst the inmates. There is honor among thieves, is there not?
Well, in the United States, prison was fairly reasonable in that it was, in the federal prison system in the United States, is run like the military. Everything is yes sir, no sir, 3 bags full. You fell in line, you did what you were told to do, and you acted the way you were supposed to act. And people, in Terminal Island, for example, there were 1,300 of us in a space built for just over 400. So you've never been surrounded by so many accommodating people who were just trying to stay out of everybody else's way. And it was really pretty reasonable. In the United States, if you find yourself in a federal prison, it's because of the type of crime you've committed. In Canada, however, it was a different story. In Canada, you find yourself in federal prison because of the amount of time you're given, because of the sentence is 2 years or more. And so in Canada, for the most part, people who get sentences of 2 years or greater will have committed a violent crime. So consequently, the federal prisons in Canada are filled with invasive, violent behaving people, and it's a little bit harder to do time in Canada than it is in the U.S.
What did you learn most out of your prison experience?
What did I learn most from my prison experience? I learned that no matter what I think, as long as as I trust my heart to pull me through, I can get through anything, and not only get through it intact, but get through it in a growing way. And I learned that flowers grow from manure. They don't grow from sterile soil. And, buddy, that was manure.
Something about, I want to ask about the drug culture, because I know nothing about it. People that deal and sell, they're not usually users, or are they?
Well, everybody that I knew that was in the business liked to smoke a joint and liked to drink a glass of wine and occasionally do a line. Most of the people I knew in the business weren't addicts or alcoholics. I just happened to be have a coke problem. I didn't have a drinking problem, or I had a coke and cigarette problem, I guess. I was a big cigarette smoker, and I liked to snort a lot of coke. And for a number of years, you know, coke seemed like a lot of fun. And then it seemed, in an instant, it turned on me and everybody else who was doing it at the same time. It stopped being fun for everybody, and most people could stop, and I couldn't. I chased a memory for a number of years. I kept doing the same thing, expecting different results, expecting something different to happen. I finally learned that if I wanted something different to happen, I had to do something different to begin with.
Now, on that path to doing something different, there was an ad in the paper that you had, I guess this was in 2001,
yeah.
in a Toronto paper.
National Post.
You put this in.
Yeah.
I think I remember seeing this. And it was a compelling read. What did it say?
It said, marijuana smuggler seeks legal means to support his wife and family, and it listed the attributes that I learned in the business over the years. Here's how it happened, Joe. My wife and I had been just gotten off parole, and we were struggling to make a living. And she said to me, "Brian, you've got to go get a job." And I said, "Honey, where am I going to get a job, and who's going to hire me?" She said, "Well, you couldn't have spent all those years in that business and not learned something." And she said, "Just write down the attributes that you figure you got in that business." So I sat down and I wrote that, basically what became that ad. And I looked at it and I said, "Yeah, I'm rushing right down to Midland Wall and getting a job as a stockbroker with this." And we both had a little laugh over that. And then in an instant it occurred to me that I should just put this in the paper and see what happens. What the heck? I mean, I won't put my name on it. I'll just put a reply to a post office box. And so I just said, "The heck with it, I'm going to do that." So I went to the Globe and Mail, and they turned me down.
Really?
And I pointed out to the Globe and Mail the content of the ad when I was trying to buy the place, position in the paper. So I said, "Well, I'm going to go to the Post and give it to them. I'm not going to point out the content of the ad and just see what happens." I just phoned them up, and I said, "I've got an ad. I want to run it on page 3 of the paper. I want it to run on Monday or a Thursday," is what I said. "And I want it on page 3 in a 4-inch by 2-inch piece right in the middle of page 3. And they said, "Send us the copy and we'll send you back a blue line." So I sent them the copy and I faxed it to them. And I got a phone call about, an hour later from a woman at the Post. And she said, "Look, I don't think we can run this ad on page 3, but we'd for the same money, we'll run it in the classified section of the Financial Times, the Financial Post, and we'll give you a whole week for the same dough." And I said, "Well, I want it on page 3. And she said, "Look, believe me, no matter where you run this ad in the paper, it's going to get attention. So my suggestion is take this and we'll run it." So I said, "Okay, fine." So she said, "Okay, we'll send you back a blue line of what it's going to look in the classified section." She sent it back to me, and it didn't have a headline. It just said "Employment Wanted." So I phoned her back, and I said, "What, only reporters can have headlines? I want a headline in this that says, 'Former Marijuana Smuggler.'" So she said, "Well, let me call you back." And she called me back in about 10 minutes and said, "Okay." And I said, "It'll be $1,300. And I said, "Fine, let's go." So that was on a Wednesday. She said, "It'll run from Monday to Friday next week." On Thursday morning, I got a phone call from a guy at the Post. He said, "Hi, Brian, my name is Charlie Gillis, and I work at the National Post." And I said, "Uh-huh." And I thought it was someone from ad had no name in it, just had reply to the post. He said, I see you're running an ad in the paper on Monday, and I wanted to do an interview with you. And I said, wait a minute. How do you know that's me? Who told you that was me? That's confidential information.
Right.
And I was upset with him. And he said, look, Brian, somebody's going to do a story on this. You're running an ad in our paper. We can't let anyone scoop us on this. So, you know, I'm going to do a story on it and on you, and I want to do it with you, not without you. So I said, I got to call you back, Charlie. So I called my brother, who is my lawyer, and I said, what the heck? And he said, what, you think you could grab that tiger by the tail? Forget about it. So he said, my suggestion is to work with him, to go talk to him, to let him interview you, because would you rather he did it without you? Of course, the answer was no. So I called him, and as it turned out, Charlie is a beautiful guy, a very sweet man, and he wrote a really great and honest and forthright article about my life that appeared on the front page of the paper on Monday along with the ad, and then again on Tuesday it made the front page, and on Wednesday it made page 3, so it was it sustained, and that ad ended up on the internet and went around the world. As a result, I received about 600 responses.
Just to the ad itself in the post office box, or because of the articles?
No, just because of the ad. The ad ended up being sent, one day I'd get 15 letters from China. The next day I'd get 10 or 15 from Australia. A couple of days later I'd get 20 from the Czech Republic. So I could tell where the ad was going around the world by the way the mail was coming at me. And I got written responses from police departments around the world asking me to come and work with them, from customs people, from organ smugglers, dope smugglers, every multi-level marketing business in the world, and so on.
This is one aspect of a really, really fascinating book, so I do suggest you pick it up to get more. Brian, thanks so much for joining us today, and congratulations on a great book, and continued good luck.
Oh, Joe, thank you so much for having me. It's been really great speaking with you, and I love your website, and I encourage everybody to just tune it in.
And then do pick up the book. Thanks very much, Brian. The book is called High: Confessions of a Pot Smuggler, $34.95 from Random House. I'm Joseph Plana.